Welcome to another episode of Bonding Time. I'm Brett Bolton, and today we have Tom Kozlik from Hilltop Securities. Tom, I hope your 2022 is off to a fantastic start. It's good to have you back. I know it's been several weeks and months here.
Happy New Year. It's good to be back. And there's a lot happening to start the new year, a lot that I wasn't expecting to be paying close attention to, but that's what the outlooks are for.
2022 sure feels like March of 2020, but we'll dig into that a little bit later.
It really does. It really does.
It's terrifying and exciting all at the same time, Tom. So let's start with 2021. I know you had a fairly robust outlook for issuance expectations last year. And I know in our prior conversations, we also expected COVID to slowly dissipate, as it did appear like it was doing so for some time. And I know that talk of the golden age of public finance following just massive flows of federal funding to state and local governments was also a topic of conversation throughout last year. So looking back here, 3 weeks into 2022, what are your thoughts on 2021? Did it reach your expectations? Has it started a new golden age of public finance?
Let's start with the beginning of 2021, because I think one of the most important things that happened in 21 was that the Democrats won those runoff elections in Georgia, right? I think that really set up what it was that was likely to happen. Once I saw that happen, I immediately knew that there was going to be some kind of significant next phase of COVID relief. And I also had a strong feeling that there was going to be direct relief for state and local governments. Going back to the end of March of 2020, Speaker Pelosi, and I recall this very clearly, as Speaker Pelosi, as the CARES Act was being finalized, knew that there wasn't going to be significant direct aid for state and locals in the CARES Act, specifically said that that was one of the things that she was going to be working to getting. It was very much a political hot potato in all of 2020. And I didn't think it was going to happen. And I didn't think it was going to happen until the Democrats won those Georgia elections. And that's really what it is that set up lawmakers, or I should say the Democrats, to slam through the $1.9 trillion Rescue Plan Act.
Right. That seems so far away, but it was fairly recent. And you're right. It seemed like such a niche issue at the time, but the two Georgia seats, that definitely opened the window for additional direct funding that came pretty quickly. And I think really set the stage for legislating last year. In your mind, and we'll dig into the whiffs on muni provisions here in a bit, but what was the most impactful piece of legislation for muni world in 2021? Or I guess 2020 for that matter, was it the CARES funding or was it the bipartisan infrastructure law in 2021 that threw another $500 or $600 billion directly at state and locals?
So the CARES Act itself, that was $2.7 trillion of COVID-focused relief. That was the largest single phase of COVID relief that we saw come out of Washington in 2020 and 2021. I don't want to say it didn't have an impact to public finance. It definitely had an impact to public finance, because that is one of the reasons of why it is that overall revenues generally just did not drop off. That the CARES Act is one of the things in my mind that helped prop up the overall economy. So it definitely had an impact on public finance. But I'd say that the legislation that had the more impactful influence on public finance was definitely the Rescue Plan Act. The CARES Act, the 2020 CARES Act, had about $150 billion of relief that could only be used by state and local governments for COVID-specific purposes. And the CARES Act also included the MLF, the Municipal Liquidity Facility, as I'm sure a lot of folks remember. Those were the two big items that were focused on public finance in the CARES Act. The Rescue Plan Act, the 2021 Rescue Plan Act, included, by my account, $650 billion for public finance. $350 billion was for state and locals. We saw about $130 billion go to schools. And then the balance of that went to sectors like higher education, healthcare, housing. And the $650 billion that was focused on public finance, that was really the big reason of why it is that I started talking about the fact that this time period could be or should be considered a golden age for public finance, because not only in 2020 and 2021, but even going back to the Recovery Act, for example, the 2009 Recovery Act. The 2009 Recovery Act was about $830 billion all in, and there was about $282 billion of assorted fiscal assistance for state and local governments. And so that is much less than that $650 billion that we saw in the Rescue Plan Act. So I really think that Rescue Plan Act, to me, is not only the most impactful that we saw in the COVID period, but one of the most impactful things coming out that came out of Washington in recent years for the public finance sector.
That's just a staggering amount of money. Yeah. Once you put it in a lineup like that, that's just incredible.
Yeah.
What about the misses this last year? Actually, let's start with the few muni provisions in the bipartisan law, all private activity bonds, right? So for broadband, carbon capture, and then I think the most important would be the doubling of the highway bond cap from 15 to 30 billion annually. I know that there was much hope with Democrats taking over both chambers of Congress, as well as Biden ascending to the presidency, that folks such as Richard Neal, House Ways and Means Chairman, and others in the House and Senate would be able to get some of these provisions across the finish line. Unfortunately, at this point, and looking forward to the likely will continue to be the case that no additional muni provisions will be signed into law this year. Did that have any impact on your predictions? Or I know that you've long have baked that into the predictions cake, I believe, but what type of impact, especially advance refunding, the miss on that solo provision, what kind of impact do you see that having?
So frankly, never thought that there was a really strong chance that that was going to happen.
We always enjoyed your pessimism on bonding time.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess I'll share with the listeners what my thinking was. What my thinking was is that if there was, once lawmakers got to the point where they started talking about the potential for a bipartisan agreement on infrastructure, and once they started to whittle those numbers down, and when they got to something that was close to $500 billion of new spending and $500 billion plus of upping some old programs, I had a feeling, I can't say that I knew because we didn't know, but I had a feeling that it was not likely that the municipal-friendly elements, specifically the what a lot of us have been calling the BABS Part 2 or bringing back tax-exempt advance refundings, once it was clear that those were not likely to be included in the bipartisan infrastructure legislation, I had a feeling that it just wasn't going to happen. Now, it was possible that it would have been included in whatever draft of Build Back Better was likely to materialize, and those elements were included in that $3.5 trillion draft of Build Back Better. But even at that point, it was very unlikely, based on what the moderates in the Senate were saying when that number was at $3.5 trillion, that the number was in fact going to be $3.5 trillion, right? It just was not likely that that was going to happen. And it also didn't seem to me those municipal elements, as much as they might have been championed by a few folks, as you mentioned, they were not anywhere near the central part of the progressive agenda, number one, nor did they really have a strong enough amount of support like something like SALT, right? Where lawmakers...
Which they still can't find an answer for the record.
Well, yeah. They still can't find an answer for, but I guess the way that I've been describing SALT is that if lawmakers want to get Build Back Better done, they're going to have to include something SALT related, because there have been a large enough important number of lawmakers that have been really pushing for SALT and for Build Back Better to get done. It really seems like that's something that it's going to be expensive, if not one of the most expensive things included in Build Back Better. But it looks like they might not get enough support for Build Back Better if they don't include it. That being said, you correct me if I'm wrong, but my read is that that is something that still continues to be an item that the progressives are not happy with.
It's going to have to be used as a bargaining chip, I assume, from the progressives, yeah, because especially in the Senate, one or two vote veto, I can imagine Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, they've made their opinions well known on this topic. So it'll definitely have to come with some concessions from the moderates, one would assume.
But I guess I, going back to the beginning, let's maybe say the middle of the summer, because I remember once there were two things that I was waiting for to happen before I revised my issuance forecast last year. I'd never revised an issuance forecast. Usually I publish an issuance forecast and then I, you know, look to see what changed and see how close or far away I am. But last year was different. Last year, because of the significant changes and especially because of that Rescue Plan Act and how much was going to public finance, I had to publish an issuance forecast. So I knew I was going to be publishing an issuance forecast after the Democrats won those runoffs. But what I was waiting for, and the reason I waited until July, is because there was also the chance that these municipal-friendly elements could have been included in something infrastructure-focused. But once we got, I gave lawmakers a July 4th deadline. And once nothing really materialized as of that July 4th deadline, and as far away as they seemed, that's when it is that I said to myself, okay, it doesn't look like these things are going to happen this year. And even if they did by the end of the year, it wasn't going to make a big enough difference for the issuance forecast. And so it was this, the beginning, say the middle of the summer, when I published that $460 billion number. But even if I would have published that back in March, it would have been, the number would have been very close. It would have been something between 450 and 475. That's what I was thinking. Like I said, getting back to your initial question, I really just did not, you know, if there would have been some kind of BAB Part 2 program and or advance refundings, it absolutely would have made a difference in my issuance forecast. I can't tell you exactly what would have been because I didn't get that far, because I just didn't think it was going to happen. But it definitely would have made a difference for the amount of taxable issuance, for sure. And it definitely would have made a difference for the amount of the tax-exempt side, because some of that tax-exempt issuance would have been pulled to the taxable side in the form of those BABs, potentially. But again, we just didn't get anywhere close to that. So that's not something that I was seriously considering.
Let's go back to where we started the conversation. 2022 now looks an awful lot like the beginning of 2020. We're in the midst of a spectacularly high surge of COVID numbers. And just curious, what's your outlook for this year? How much is COVID going to affect your outlook? At this point, it might be premature. Do you foresee any need for additional federal funds? And let's just go from there, if that's okay with you.
I'd like to review the details, because I had a couple of dozen conversations with people. I'll keep this to, you know, a few minutes, not half an hour. But the details matter here, because on the one hand, I think that the press has been, and even analysts and strategists have been, describing Omicron wave as more contagious but less deadly. On the surface, and or when you look at some statistics, that's what's happening. But I think that, and the reason of why it is that I agree with your assessment, in that where we are to begin 2022 is to a degree similar to where we were in March and April of 2020. There's some differences. Like, one of the big differences is that there are some very effective vaccines out there, very effective vaccines. That being said, we now are in a wave that where we're seeing cases well over 700,000 to 800,000cases a day. That is well above the worst of the number of cases that we saw in the beginning of last year. There were about a little over 200,000 cases a day. That illustrates the fact that the Omicron variant is more contagious. So statistically, that part's true. But one of the things that's happening, where and hospitalizations are already above the peak that we saw around this time last year. Again, the good thing is that there are effective vaccines. The vaccination rate nationally is about 63%. The majority of the people who are being hospitalized, however, are typically not vaccinated. And to me, the two troubling issues The first has to do with where deaths are right now. Deaths are almost to 2,000 a day. They're about 1,800 a day. That's where they've been for the last day or two. And deaths are continuing to rise. Deaths typically don't peak until 3 to 4 weeks after the cases peak. And we're recording this on January 20th. And we're already hearing, and it makes sense to me that we're hearing this, that the number of cases have already peaked and are starting to decline in the Northeast and large cities like Boston and New York and DC. But the number of cases have yet to peak in the middle of the United States and in the Western and Southern United States. The number of deaths per day at the peak last year was about 3,300. The CDC over the last couple of weeks, and I've been following this pretty closely, has revised higher the ceiling of the number of deaths that they're expecting. And I don't want to say, when I say this number, it's not their specific forecast. This is just the ceiling. Their ceiling has gone from 4,100 deaths a day to 5,100 deaths a day as of Wednesday of this week. Again, that's not necessarily the specific number that they're expecting. That's just the ceiling. But even if that number gets to or surpasses the 3,300, or even if it stays close to where it is now, that's still a very high number, number one. That's a very negative impact from a healthcare perspective that I don't think most people were expecting in November, December. And I know most people don't know about right now because of the dozens of people who I've talked to about this in recent weeks. None of them, not one, knew what those death numbers looked like, number one, or what the forecasts looked like. But even if the healthcare impact wasn't as negative as what it is I just described, just the stop, just the way, the fact that this wave is here and it's as big as it is, and it's as impactful to the economy, not only from a overall economic standpoint, but from a labor market standpoint. This is one of the reasons of why it is, you know, schools aren't being closed or going virtual necessarily because of health, specific health conditions. They're being closed because people can't get to work. People can't go to the schools to work. And that's happening in other sectors as well. It's happening in a lot of sectors where people need to be there in person. And if this is something that's going to continue during this wave, and one of the other big takeaways that I have from Omicron is that there's nothing that leads me to believe that we're not going to see a Delta or an Omicron part two wave, Delta part two, whatever the variant happens to be, in the summer of 22, and then an Omicron part two in, you know, January and February of 23. There's nothing that tells me that those can't happen. If anything, what it is that we've seen already is that those are likely to happen. It's just a matter of how contagious whatever variant it is evolves in the summer or in the winter and how lethal it is, right? So I was much more optimistic, I should say, about this golden age continuing into 2022 at the beginning of December when I was doing my 22 outlooks than I am now, because we were hearing from doctors that the Omicron wave was going to be more contagious but less deadly, but we didn't know exactly what the numbers were going to look like, and we didn't know that these waves that were going to impact economic activity were going to be as impactful, I think, as what they are. And that, and also, I think that what this really does show is that there very well could just be a new normal or pattern of waves like this in the future, unless something else changes. Unfortunately, it's a negative or bummer of an outlook or story, but that's where we sit now, I believe.
I hate to agree with you on that point, but I tend to agree with at least your assessment as it stands today. So any topics, additional topics you want to hit on before we end on the positive note, Tom, or have we covered everything you'd like to today?
One of the things that we, correct me if I'm wrong, did we talk about the likelihood of Build Back Better?
We did not.
We did
that,
not.
That is my fault because that's a pretty low likelihood. So yeah, the Build Back Better for those listening here, originally last year was a $3.5 trillion infrastructure spending plan, as we noted earlier, that included a plethora of muni-friendly provisions. Late last year, it was whittled down to a roughly $1.75 trillion package, and that still ran into a ton of headwinds, especially in the Senate. Here's looking at you, Joe Manchin, West Virginia, Kristen Sinema, Arizona. Senate Majority Leader Schumer continued to say that the bill would pass in December of last year, but here we are in late January, and frankly, between you and I, Tom, chances can't get much lower of passage of the full bill as they are today. I know that earlier this week, President Biden said that his favorite approach would be to pass it in increments, but as far as spending bills go, they require a 60-vote threshold in the Senate. Thus, you have to rely on the old budget gimmick, the, wow, I can't even remember the name, Tom, help me out here, the budget reconciliation to pass these on a party line vote, and you only get one bite at that apple a year. So that's a long-winded way to say that while some portions of that Build Back Better Act may pass, specifically, I think, the child tax credit portion of the bill, and as we discussed earlier, some type of SALT relief, I think, would have to be associated with that. Beyond that, I think it's pretty much dead. What are your takes, Tom?
So what I'm remembering very clearly is that the progressives in the House were really pushing back on voting for infrastructure unless they got some kind of assurance from the White House about the support for Build Back Better. So that is still hanging out there. I haven't heard that referenced recently. I think that to a degree, what's happened on Build Back Better, I think this is probably one of the things that Manchin has been expecting all along and or wanting all along, because I guess I'm remembering back in, I think it was even like September of last year when he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, and I think that there was a local paper that he wrote an opinion piece saying that, you know, he was talking about the things that he liked and didn't like. And, you know, I guess he really wanted to take a pause for negotiations and then start conversations when the new year started. But from what I remember towards the end of last year is that, you know, you were just talking about the $3.5 trillion number. From what I remember, Manchin's top line number was nothing higher than $1.5 trillion. I recall the White, does that sound right?
Yeah, it was in that range. I know that I'm sure his staff leaked out the one-page memo he wrote to Chuck right. Schumer laying right. out what his top lines were. And I think it was right around 1.5.
I think I remember the White House alluding to the fact that they'd like to maybe get something closer to $2 trillion. But I guess I remember Manchin's top line number being something closer to $1.5 trillion. I very clearly remember Medicare being a very big issue, saying that Senator Sanders saying that a bill with no Medicare expansion was non-negotiable. I remember paid leave being an issue. I remember all the climate change items being at issue. I remember the tax structure continuing to be at issue. The SALT, as you mentioned, was at issue. And I remember Manchin saying very clearly that he does not support an expansion of Medicare because he wants the program to be solvent before additional expenses added. And it just, when you started going back and forth with all those topics, it just sounded as though that the Democrats weren't able to come to any kind of consensus, just even within their own party, about what this was going to look like. And now that we're a little past the, you know, we're almost to the end of January, we're not to the end of January yet, but there really hasn't been any specific conversation back and forth. All that's been said are the bits and pieces like you just laid out about the White House saying potentially maybe this is going to have to be done in bits and pieces, which I doesn't seem as though that is going to end up happening in
politically
my mind.
And procedurally fraught, Tom.
Yeah.
I mean, to put it mildly.
And that being said, I don't know what the drop dead date of Congress just not paying any attention to this type of stuff is, but I'm guessing it once we get past January, February, there really isn't going to be all that much time and energy spent on this.
To be realistic, or not realistic, July 31st, right before the August recess leading up to the midterms. But you're right, politically, capital starts to run dry probably in February. You've still got appropriations and must-pass bills after that. So time is running short. And there has been no movement since December, since the Manchin Biden blow up in late December. I don't think much has happened since then.
Yeah, so that makes it so, you know, for folks that are expecting anything that was related to Build Back Better, whether it be SALT or, I mean, anything. I haven't gotten to the point where I would say that it's, did you just say that they would, I guess I'm not saying it's dead. I'm saying that it's just hanging out there still.
I mean, I think the broader package as it stood in December is dead, but would I be surprised if something else passed and they label it Build Back Better? No, no. I think that's definitely still a relatively fair possibility.
I think that your assessment of the fair possibility, the fact that this is just still hanging out there, it's not necessarily being championed by anyone.
No.
There isn't even the back and forth like we saw leading up to the end of last year. It's just hanging out there still.
There's not a single champion of where it stands today, I don't think.
I think that's probably the best way to summarize where we are.
Yeah, right now. But I mean, listen, 2017, I was dumbfounded that the tax law passed. 2021, I was pretty dumbfounded that the bipartisan infrastructure deal came together. So crazier things have happened.
And it could happen quickly.
It will happen quickly, but it's just not going to look anything like it did or does currently. So I think that's probably a good place to leave it. Yeah. A cliffhanger for the next podcast of additional actions in 2022 heading into the midterms. I think that's a good segue into that. So Tom, it was a pleasure. I hope the rest of your January plays out well, and 2022 is a fantastic year for you and yours.
Thanks very much, but to you too.